This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Budget discussions underway in Raleigh with tentative approval for the House budget, which includes a pay raise for teachers, just not as much as the governor wanted. Legislators also seem to be eyeing Charlotte's airport again, or at least they were till yesterday, with some considering eliminating tax breaks on jet fuel. In response, American Airlines was said to be on high alert. Targeting the airline could be the result of their negative reaction to HB2, but Mecklenburg Republican Dan Bishop says there could be considerable changes to that law. Duke Energy has to remove coal ash from some of its ponds. The county commission is mulling over plans for a transformation of Second Ward. Changes may be on the way as Time Warner Cable is sold, and Race Week is upon us on this Mech Deck Day. Those and other stories on our weekly local news roundup this hour. WFAE's Tom Bullock is here along with Sean Flynn, managing editor at Time Warner Cable News. Or is that Charter Communications Cable News?
I'll let you know Spectrum. As soon as I know.
Okay. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer from the Charlotte Business Journal, is here, and so is Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back, everybody.
Thank you.
Budget
Be
time here. in Raleigh, and on Wednesday night, House lawmakers gave tentative approval, and I think it was approved last night, to a budget. The last figure I had was $22.2 billion, and WFAE reported earlier this week that these budget debates are often rancorous, but this time around it appeared that lawmakers were all vying for the Miss Congeniality Award. What's up, Tom?
Well, I have to say I was pretty surprised. The debate, the first debate, the key debate really when it comes to budget fights, happened Wednesday, and this is the first vote in whichever chamber introduces the budget. They take turns. This time it was the House. And listening to the Finance Appropriations Committee meeting the day before, things got pretty partisan. You know, there were claims that one lawmaker tried to add an amendment in that would reestablish what's known as the earned income tax credit. And immediately, Republicans on the Finance Committee said, this is just an election year gambit. You don't really care about the earned income tax credit. This is Democrats versus Republicans. So when I settled in for what I thought would be
– Settled in.
I think – well, yeah.
Side chat.
You've covered these before, Eric. You know what it means. I mean, these things can go on for hours and hours.
Smoking jacket.
Hours and hours. And it was over relatively quickly, and the tone was surprisingly cordial. I mean, the bill passed. The budget passed both votes, 103 votes to 12.
With 30 Democrats voting in favor.
That's correct. The most that I could see since Republicans took over the House and did the first budget in 2011. And what debate there was really just seemed to be focused on the idea that Republican lawmakers in the House have set aside $300 million to go into the state's rainy day fund. It's basically a savings account for the state they can use to, you know, pull money from when financially things get lean. And it takes that number, what's in that account now, up to $1.4 billion if the Senate agrees, and that would be a record amount. So, you know, Minority Leader Larry Hall said, look, we could actually do better than that. It would be better for the state to spend this money than it is to save this money. And he used this interesting analogy that any homeowner would understand, which is basically we have a hole in our roof. We're not going to spend the money to fix the roof. We're going to wait until we have to replace the roof. Now, that
interest rates are higher.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, ideologically, and in fairness, I still love this as a fact, the lead budget writer's name in the House of Representatives is Nelson Dollar. And that's just great.
Fate.
But he just brought up the
Hello,
fact.
Hello, Charles Dickens.
He just brought up the fact that, you know, he was prepared to talk about everything that everybody had done since Republicans took over in his closing statements. But he was so surprised with the overall tenor of the debate that he said, you know, this just comes down to how we want to use that $300 million. And Republicans, he said, really just believe in trying to save just in case.
Yeah.
So this really just boiled down to a simple and cordial ideological difference
between
the parties.
But I've also heard Republicans at the state and the national level talking about if you have a slush fund, then you have collected too much money in taxes and you ought to give it back.
Oh, slush fund, such a nasty word.
So, I mean, is this not a slush fund? I mean, I think it's wise to have a rainy day fund.
Well, it's not a slush fund. Nah,
it's
not a slush fund in that kind of context because it's not like they can just easily dip into this.
Mm-hmm.
And it is set up.
Always been there, too,
and it's
we should
always,
point out.
It's
yeah.
always been there. I believe it was established by Democrats. The concept behind this is not like your classic slush fund is also. I mean, it is, in fact, a fund there, so that way if revenues for the state decline to such a level that they either have to dramatically raise taxes or cut services, there's a middle ground that they can fall
back
on.
Well, is this in response partially to the fact that the state had some severe economic troubles during the recent Great Recession?
Oh, yeah.
And they want to avoid a recurrence of that should something happen?
Yeah, that's part of it. And I think the larger budget conversation continues to go in this manner, which is that the Republican control of the General Assembly is talking about surpluses, they're talking about the rainy day fund, and they're talking about cutting taxes. Remember that since 2013, we've gone from a 6.9% corporate tax rate to what will be 3% next year. And on the other side, Democrats, what they're saying is, you're not spending enough, you're not investing in education when you should, infrastructure, and you're also that earned income tax credit anecdote that Tom mentioned is a very important one, because that is one of the key pieces on the left of helping lower income people. I mean, that is one that surfaces over and over. So I think it's the conversation's the same tenor, but the intensity has been ratcheted down.
So let's talk about some of the things that are in this budget. Teachers would get an average of 4% in terms of pay raise, with the money going mostly to mid-career teachers, not to the newbies. They got their bump last year, although I think the newer teachers would get a $1,000 bonus according
one-time
to this
bonus,
budget.
Yep.
Is this to balance what they did last year, which caused some teachers to be really upset?
I think that's a lot of what's at play, because last year they did the thing with the, a one-time bonus of $750, which teachers across the state just took as a slap in the face and an insult. And at that time, a lot of people were, including me, were saying, okay, that's the setup for the election year real raise. When they instead of doing two raises, they're thinking, well, we'll just wait until we can get real political pop for
won't
it.
Won't that look good
in
the ad?
Year.
And the other thing that always comes up is when you pay a bonus, of course, then the next time you raise, your raise looks bigger because the bonus was a one-time payment. But that's just what cynical people might say.
So what do teachers get? What's the breakdown?
Well, it varies. I mean, and you were right to bring up the fact that last year it was beginning teachers that saw the big raise and everybody else was kind of left in the wind. And they set up this system that it's a six-tiered system. So you have, beginning teachers, meaning they've spent 5 years or less in the classroom. They get that $1,000 bonus. For teachers in Tier 2, that's 5 to 9 years, they get 4.1% raise. 10 to 14 years get a 5% raise. And then from there, it starts going down. So that's that mid-career teacher level that you were talking about. For educators with 15 to 19 years in the classroom, it's 3.4%. 20 to 24 years, it's 3.2%. But here's the other thing that is interesting.
There will be a quiz, by the way.
Well,
there's a 2% pay raise for state government workers, and this is bigger than those raises.
That's correct. Yes. That is correct. But state workers also get a $500 one-time bonus. But you're right. But let's face it, to get to Eric's point, you do get a much larger election year bump from raising teacher pay than you would for raising the pay of people at the DMV.
Because there are more teachers.
No, because it makes a better ad to say, look, we are taking care of the kids.
It's also harder for the teachers to and the unions, associations, forgive me, to say they're not helping us out when here they are giving them this huge election year.
And remember, the other argument that the governor and others will make is by doing what they did last year, they're getting more and better qualified people into the teaching pool. And so that's why they did that and came back.
So I think we're 47th in the country in teacher pay. I think that's
41st.
41st. Okay, that's close. What does this do to that?
Well, we don't know. And lawmakers were talking about during the debates that this would bump us up into the high 30s. But that's – first of all
– that involved some interesting semantics, though.
Yes.
I recall the explanation was rather detailed.
Well, but the high 30s, first of all, and this is what some Democratic lawmakers brought up, is that really where we want to see ourselves and pat ourselves on the back? But the more important thing is – it only brings us up to the high 30s if no one else, if the other 50 states and the District of Columbia provide no raises
to
their
teachers.
That's the
fine print I was mentioning, yes.
it makes us the highest paid, makes North Carolina teachers the highest paid on average in the Southeast, but the Southeast is also home to the lowest paid teachers.
And remember, I believe, correct me, Tom, or anyone else here if I'm wrong, I think the per pupil spending is still lagging.
Yeah, it is.
To a pretty high degree compared to what's going on.
But it definitely is. But you can say that I think the Republicans do make a fair point in that it hasn't just been their fault that per pupil
spending. Oh, that's
true.
Absolutely.
It's a function of the recession, which happened during a Democratic administration, and there were all these cuts. And, you know, we're in a pretty substantial hole in terms of, you know, keeping pace on teacher spending and spending per pupil. And there is a pretty solid argument that can be made that, you know, like you were saying, Eric, that the Republicans' philosophy is to save and, you know, squirrel money away, that we're in such a hole that, you know, maybe some of that money needs to come out of the saving and squirreling away to try and catch us back up.
These raises are less than what Governor McCrory wanted. How much less?
He was calling for a 5% across the board raise. So it's about 1% less. But the other thing to remember is this is what the House wanted. This is what the House has passed.
We haven't gotten to our friends in the Senate.
Yeah. And the Senate has traditionally called for lower percentages of these raises. I believe last year the House had a higher raise for beginning teachers than the Senate. So, you know, we shouldn't talk about these as being a fait accompli because they are not.
Yeah. Well, I loved Larry Hall's statement on the floor yesterday where he said, we usually just get rolled. You know? Don't let it happen again.
Remember that, as I think everyone here does, Senator Ruccio, Bob Ruccio from Mecklenburg County, is the co-chair of the Finance Committee. He's not a big fan of taxes, so we could see other changes afoot in the Senate.
The budget as passed by the House does other things, including giving retirees, state government retirees, a 1.6% cost of living increase in benefits, 2% increase across the board for state employees, fully funding enrollment in public schools, whatever that means.
Well, I want to bring up that point. That's actually important for a real quick thing. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Sorry.
This is the last year's budget didn't have this. So school districts across the state were trying to figure out how they were going to pay for the teachers to expand classrooms because if they were growing, they needed to do that. The fact that this budget actually does fully fund student enrollment will make their planning, school districts' planning, a lot simpler and more reliable. That's a key point.
And it increases the standard income tax deduction, which is a tax cut in essence, right?
Absolutely. It's $500. It goes from $15,500 to $16,000. And without beating a dead horse but probably doing so, this goes back to the earned income tax credit debate because Republicans say this is a better way to approach it. Democrats have a different opinion.
And it also includes continued funding for the state's portion of the I-77 toll road. That project.
Listen to the applause.
That project is going to proceed.
Yes,
it
is. And Julia Howard.
High water.
Yeah,
right.
It was actually, and it was Julia Howard from Davie County who actually brought up an amendment to try to do that. That fight did not happen. It was basically like, hey, what about, no.
Okay. So the vote was finalized in the House yesterday. It now moves on to the Senate. How long does that process take? What is the likely outcome?
Hopefully not as long as it did last year.
Didn't Phil Berger say they could be gone by Memorial Day?
Yeah, we should see this actually next week.
Yeah.
Last year it seemed like they just wanted to pop a tent in Raleigh and stay there forever.
It was the extended dance remix.
Right.
Year.
And this year they can't get out of town fast enough.
Yeah. Right.
Well, they've already been here one day to do some stuff. And they don't want to tack that onto their thing. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about something that kind of came and went relatively quickly, but it put Charlotte on edge, nerves on edge in Charlotte, and that is the fact that somebody in Raleigh wanted to remove the tax breaks on fuel, jet fuel, at the airport, and that had American Airlines on high alert for a while. And believe it or not, you're going to find this hard to believe, there are some sidebar stories regarding HB2 that we're going to cover in the next segment. Yes. We haven't talked about it in so long. We're coming right back with our roundtable of reporters on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Heartwood Tree Service. 85% of tree canopy growth occurs in the spring. Heartwood exists to provide education, tree health care, and pruning to grow human appreciation. Assistance available at heartwoodtree.com. And the May 20th Society celebrating MECDEC Day at noon today in Independence Square, honoring the Mecklenburg Resolves of 1775 with a new historical marker. Event details at May 20th Society. vote.org. In January, as the first ballots were being cast in the presidential race, we brought a group of voters together to discuss the election. Voter anger seemed paramount, and at that time, and that has clearly resulted in Donald Trump's apparent success at winning the GOP nomination and in the challenges to Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton. So this week, or next week on Monday, we invite voters back to see how they stand now, or where they stand now, and we start with Republican voters on this program Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Donald Trump unveils his proposed Supreme Court nominees, Bernie Sanders tells the Democratic Party to let the people in, and the federal government promises action to fight long airport security delays.
The News Roundup continues with the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's our weekly news roundup with our roundtable of reporters, Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Sean Flynn, managing editor of Time Warner Cable News, Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, and Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Before we move on, Dennis on Facebook. By the way, you're invited to join us by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org.
I thought he meant us.
Or you can use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. You can also get us through Facebook or Twitter. Okay, now, Dennis on Facebook writes, let us see if I have this right. The legislature wants to increase their per diem pay while commuting to and staying in Raleigh, but wants to reduce the proposed increase in teacher pay, right? Bless their hearts.
Well, and he's right.
He's got a point there.
All right. Charlotte's lobbyist in Raleigh raised some concerns a couple of days ago over the possibility that state lawmakers might decide to target American Airlines over that company's opposition to HB2 by cutting the jet fuel tax breaks. That put American on high alert. Who's behind it, and was that just a flash in the pan?
Well, it's kind of unclear where all that really came from, except that the city's lobbyist sent an email to city council saying that there are these concerns that something might happen with the fuel tax exemption. Now, whether or not those were legitimate, founded, well-founded fears or not, or whether or not that was actually attached to HB2, it's kind of unclear.
The airline has not commented yet, correct?
Correct. Not to my knowledge.
Right. So let's go back in time a little bit. American Airlines lobbied successfully last year to preserve and extend a state law that capped the company's jet fuel taxes at $2.5 million a year. That cap was set to expire this year, but lawmakers, I think, took a couple of steps further exempting jet fuel from sales.
For all airlines, not just American.
Okay. Yes. If this happens, what would American Airlines' likely reaction be? I mean, this is the heart and soul of the airport.
The first thing I want to bring up is this still could happen. This still very much could be alive. And here's why. And it may or may not have to do with House Bill 2. Senator Bob Rucho, who we've already talked about today, who we're going to talk about a lot more as the attention in Raleigh now shifts to the Senate, mm-hmm. He has been against this particular business carve-out for a long time. And I spoke
all
to
business carve-outs, not just American Airlines?
He's pretty against them, yeah. And he's pretty, you know, I have to say he is steadfast in this opinion. And it's not just this one. This, you know, American Airlines last year saved, I believe it's about $25 million in what they would pay the state in taxes because mm-hmm. of this. Now, they just signed a new lease at Charlotte Douglas, I believe, for 10 years.
Correct.
And this is their second largest hub. But $25 million, it's a decent chunk of change for any corporation. It's not something that people would blink at. Do we know what American will do? No. Do we know if this would make them suddenly pull stakes and move from Charlotte? No. The hub and spoke system is pretty complicated. It would take time to find a replacement for a facility as important to their system as Charlotte's. But could it influence them possibly get that ball rolling? We don't know yet.
Well, and here is the issue. Let's go back in time to those fun days when we were talking about Jerry Orr and losing the airport to the state of North Carolina. You know, the argument for American Airlines and basically the success of Charlotte Douglas is that it is cheap for airlines to fly there because there's no reason to have Charlotte as a hub. I mean, 80% of the traffic out there is obviously coming in from other places. So that was the big lobbying effort last year by American is – look, we need to keep our costs low so that we can still maintain this level of service from Charlotte. So that's why people in Charlotte, and particularly in the business community, get really nervous. They start to break out in hives whenever American sneezes.
Not only is there no sales tax on jet fuel, landing fees are low.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons that they were able to build this hub. If that hub were to disappear, what would happen?
It would be the single most devastating economic thing that could happen to Charlotte.
And that's not hyperbole.
No,
I mean, here's the thing. The airport itself, it's not that the airport itself generates huge sums of money that then goes into Charlotte's coffers directly. But if you look at the reason why companies come to Charlotte, or frankly, one of the biggest pitches of Northern South Carolina, it's access to this airport.
Yep, right.
And that is a major driving factor. So if that disappears, It really is.
Yeah, if you look at every single economic development announcement we've had over the last even, let's say, decade, every single one of them, number one is that airport. And I did a special series when I traveled over to Germany last year, and I talked to all these German companies, and we have more than 200 in the Charlotte region now, and all of them are saying the reason why we chose Charlotte is because of that airport.
Yeah.
So absolutely, hands down, the airport is the number one
and that's
economic
been the advantage
engine in this area.
Over a city like Birmingham or even Nashville or, you know, in the southeast, is that you usually have to fly through Atlanta or Chicago or wherever,
so,
and here you can fly direct.
When they bring these things up, these ideas about raising jet fuel or whatever it may be, are they playing Russian roulette? I mean, because that makes people antsy.
I think to a large degree they kind of are. I understand that Bob Ruscio and other guys like him in the General Assembly have principles, and this is one of their principles, that they do not believe in playing favorites, as they call it, with the tax code among businesses. But this is not, you know, all businesses aren't created necessarily equal in terms of their impact on the local economy and the regional economy and American Airlines. You know, rightly or wrongly, whether or not this tax carve out is, you know, something that they really need or that they just like having, or whether or not they would stay without it, or would they, wouldn't they? It's just not a question we want to tempt fate to find out.
Mike, this is a lot like the argument about incentives. You know,
well, this is an incentive. I mean, it really is.
Well, yeah, but I mean, recruiting incentives. It's a lot like recruiting incentives because, you know, people hate them. But then, of course, I think every politician, the first thing they say is, well, we wish we didn't have to do it, but other people do it, so we do have to do it. And there is some truth to that because, you know, obviously American and other carriers get benefits from other states. And again, I just think that the biggest problem is that Charlotte and North Carolina are operating at a disadvantage when it comes to keeping a major hub compared to Chicago, Dallas.
Yeah, I think
the
thing that would need to happen in order for us to sort of even out that leverage, because right now we don't have leverage against an American Airlines. We would have to sort of diversify our economy more and maybe get a bigger sort of economic footprint to where the airports of that size is actually justified, and it's not just because of the good graces or whatever of an American Airlines and the decision makers in their boardroom. It's because they see dollars and cents advantages to having that level of service here.
So the impetus for this was rumored to be the airline's opposition to HB2, and that may or may not be true, but whether or not it's true, Mecklenburg Republican Dan Bishop says there might be possible significant changes coming to HB2. How so?
Well, what he told me this week is that there could be significant changes with a very large caveat that I think a lot of us have talked about, which is Charlotte would have to repeal the ordinance that was passed in February. So if Charlotte City Council would do that, go ahead.
I'm just going to say, why do we have to repeal it?
Two reasons.
If it has been defeated and rendered neutered. It's been neutered.
There are two reasons that Representative Bishop and others give. Mm-hmm. The first is that if for some reason or inclination the legislature was to repeal HB2, then the Charlotte ordinance would take
effect.
And they don't want that, obviously. The second reason, though, is more interesting and gets, I think, to the heart of the contentiousness in the matter, which is Representative Bishop says that it is a sign of sort of good faith in negotiations that Charlotte would get rid of the ordinance that a lot of people, obviously, in the state legislature feel started all of this.
So what is the possibility that Charlotte City Council might actually repeal the ordinance?
Well, I mean, remember, you know, I think the first inclination is to laugh. But remember, there were four people who voted against this. Right. And we asked Mayor Roberts last week if she would veto, you know, if this was repealed. And she really didn't give an answer. But the mayor is really less important than the council here. So if you could find three more votes to withstand a veto, if that happened, you know, and it's possible.
And there's signs that you're that at least one vote possibly might be starting to change, and that's the vote of James Mitchell. Mm-hmm. He ran on passing this ordinance. Mm-hmm. He voted for the ordinance, and now he's asking for numbers and causing a little, I would say, distrust among his fellow council members. He's asking for the economic impact numbers to start kind of taking a look at what House Bill 2
because
has
cost Charlotte.
Because
that's how the argument will – I think Tom is exactly right, because that's where the argument will go to is, wait a minute, we have an NBA All-Star game. We have companies pulling out. And so if you're going to try and retract a vote, whether it's James Mitchell or anyone else, you would need that evidence to say, look, I'm going to hold my nose and do this because we can maybe find some sort of compromise to preserve all these things that are threatened by HB2.
And it would be like – it's such an interesting question about whether or not that would be a politically
– palatable?
Palatable vote for somebody like a James Mitchell, because on the one hand, we know that even though HB2 is – you know, does have a good bit of support statewide in Charlotte, that support is much – that's much less. And most people in Charlotte did vote that city council in
on
with
this
the understanding so that they would do what they did. So would James Mitchell reversing field, would that hurt him? Or are people just so sick of the whole HB2 mess that they just want it to go away and they would see him as, you know, helping it to just go away and we can get back to life as normal?
Why not just wait for the court's decision?
Well, a couple reasons. One is, of course, the court decision is going to take many, many months. If not years. And the damage continues during that. And remember, I think this gets lost a lot. The court matter is only dealing with Section 1 of HB2. There are two other big pieces of HB2 that are troubling to plenty of companies and others. And so you can't just sort of shut the door and say, well, we'll let the courts figure it out.
And to decipher for people who haven't read the bill what Eric just said, the court cases really seem focused on the actual bathroom provisions of this law. There are a ton of other provisions. We can't say this enough. I mean, you know, making it impossible for municipalities to pass minimum wage, that may or may not have been possible before, but this makes it very clear that they cannot. This also eliminates the ability for someone to sue for discrimination on any grounds in state court. I mean, that can be everything from your employer deciding that you're too old, so I'm going to fire you for your age, to someone not liking the green sweater that you're wearing right now, Mike, and so they say you're out.
Why didn't the Department of Justice go after that part of it?
Well, I think a lot of the reason is for things such as, let's just take one of them, which is quashing any ability by municipalities to pass ordinances that would extend similar protections. That is a right provided in the state constitution. In other words, the city of Charlotte and all other cities and towns exist at the pleasure of the state. And so there's not a legal challenge really to be mounted there. You know, some of these things in these other sections don't really have much recourse in terms of legal lawsuit to fight back.
So speaking of HB2, and I think this is your story, Eric Frazier, I think it is. The Pat McCrory campaign is now tracking Attorney General Roy Cooper's statements. Is it you? Or is it the other Eric?
Well, yeah.
Or lack thereof over this bill and the Obama administration's nationwide edict on transgender bathroom rights. But you say that the Attorney General is calling for debates at which this issue would certainly come up.
Well, yeah. Now I think they've agreed to debates, right?
They have.
But, yeah, it's just been kind of interesting to see the political calculus that both sides are kind of waging around HB2. And it seemed like initially that the scale, you know, of political advantage, who has a political advantage, it was kind of pointing towards Roy Cooper. And then when the Obama administration did its directive and the nationwide letter, and you got all this sort of national blowback on, you know, why is the federal government, you know, bullying local school districts and telling them what to do with their bathroom policies. Now you see, I think, Governor McCrory and the GOP sort of trying to, you know, hone in on Roy Cooper's – what is his response to Obama's directive? And Roy Cooper's been a little quiet.
If I might add, prior to the passage of HB2 and post-city council vote, so that in-between period, we actually reached out to Roy Cooper on two occasions on the same day. We interviewed him in Raleigh. And we interviewed him in Charlotte. And the reason why we had to interview him in Charlotte is because we didn't understand what he said regarding Charlotte's law. And so we asked him again in Charlotte, and he talked a lot. But at the end of it, our entire newsroom was like, what does he mean by what he's talking about? He says a lot, but it wasn't clear. And then I think once HB2 was passed, it then became a very clear message right. for him. But prior to that, I don't know exactly what he was trying to say. It was very unclear.
It was muddled.
It was very muddled. It's – well, state law already addresses a lot of this. Well, it addresses what? What does it address? Does it address the city's ordinance, or does it address that they can't do it? And we kept asking those questions, and we'd answer it the same way. So that was a little frustrating. There was one day in particular, I remember the whole newsroom having a discussion on what Roy Cooper was talking about.
Mm-hmm. You spent some time this week, Eric Spanberg, talking to Evangelist Franklin Graham, who has been openly critical of those who oppose HB2, including PayPal and Mayor Roberts and the president. And he said that he hopes Roberts' time in office is short-lived, and asked, who does President Obama think he is, the Sultan of Washington? Let me ask you this. Do you think he's more political than his father was? I struggled to come up with a question based on your story, a question that could be asked in this forum.
I, as you said, he's been vocal in his opposition. The thing that struck me was that he was so specific about Mayor Jennifer Roberts. That was the part I didn't expect, that he would come out so forcefully against Charlotte and what has happened.
Well,
here.
He was very specific about a lot of things. This really leapt off the page for me. You say he went into graphic detail with you about how he doesn't want to go into a bathroom stall and hear women come into the stall next to him and grunt and groan.
That's what he said.
Oh.
That's what he said. The point I think he was making there was that it is an issue of privacy that is
How is that different from having a man sit next to you in the stall next to you and grunt and groan?
I have to admit I did not ask that follow-up question. But
I don't really like anybody sitting next to me.
True. That's true. Exactly right.
Me.
You know, I think what he was trying to hammer home there was the fact that this is such a personal, private matter that it shouldn't be up for public debate. I think, you know, I will let the answer speak for themselves.
Well, you asked him about CEOs and companies advocating for the repeal of the law, and his response was, why don't they stay out of it? Did you turn the question around?
No, because I was really wanting to – I asked him more – I kept asking him about business and – what he thought Governor McCrory and the legislature were doing. I thought one of the most interesting parts of his business answer was that these are a lot of companies from California, which, of course, there are plenty of companies that are here. You know, Bank of America would be just one example. But you want to ask pointed questions, but I did not argue every single point with him, okay. I guess, would be my answer.
I think sometimes, too, it's best just to let people talk because
right. – Oh, yeah.
Just because.
Yeah.
And I would argue that while you said Franklin is more political, I would say his dad was very political, but behind the scenes.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more on Kolash and Art Pope. They go together on WFAU. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and ScoopCharlotte.com, providing women in Charlotte daily info on shopping, fitness, dining, and things to do. Presenting the Scoop each week with ScoopCharlotte.com. And Atrium Animal Hospital and Wellness Center, providing holistic animal health care for 20 years, offering pet parents a strategy to achieve and maintain furry family vitality. AtriumAnimalHospital.com. Well, the weekly news roundup continues in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show, the National Hour. Host Allison Aubrey of NPR joins a panel of reporters for an analysis of this week's top national news. Donald Trump unveiling his proposed Supreme Court nominees. Bernie Sanders telling the Democratic Party to let the people in. And the federal government promising action to fight long airport security delays. Those stories and more than the International Hour follows at 11 on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation or comment on some of the stories that we've been covering today, you can get to us on email, Facebook, or Twitter.
I'm Duncan McFadden of Weekend Edition on WFAE. You know, weekend mornings are a good time to go exploring, to hear new ideas, writers talking about new books, actors and directors talking about new movies, thinkers, politicians, comics, plus sports, the puzzle, and of course, we'll catch you up on the latest news. Come along with us for Weekend Edition, Saturday and Sunday mornings from 8 to 10 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News. Sean Flynn, the managing editor of Time Warner Cable News. Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. And Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Why are all these people here? Why, it's the weekly news roundup. That is why.
It's raining
here.
Out.
Yes, and it's MacDeck Day. Makeovers are coming to South Boulevard and South Tryon Street. These are not beauty parlors, but these are things that could possibly save lives, at least according to CDOT. What do they want to do to South Boulevard and South Tryon, and where?
Well, they want to put more sidewalks and better pedestrian, sort of amenities in, which it's badly needed.
Because
I mean, they put the light rail through South Boulevard, through the South End, and that just, caused this explosion of development. A lot of it, pedestrian-oriented and dense, apartments. And they did not account for all these people might just want to cross South Boulevard at some point, which is this narrow, crowded street.
Wait a minute. That was the whole idea when we sat here 10 years ago or 15 years ago, talking about this, what the light rail would do.
Yeah. It's the whole.
It's one of the pieces of the vision.
One piece of the vision that was never addressed is the rules and regulations in Charlotte and North Carolina that basically say you really only kind of need a sidewalk somewhere. I mean, this is the only state that I've lived in, and I've lived in a bunch of states, where you often only see one sidewalk, not on both sides,
right,
but on one side,
right,
if you see any sidewalk at all. I would love to bike from my home to work, but I can't because there's not a single place on Harris Boulevard that has a continuous chain of a sidewalk, not on either side. And that's the fact that they didn't compensate for that in a place that was built to generate pedestrian traffic. This is a decision that is way overdue.
So where would this be on South Boulevard, South Tryon? Where would it be?
It would be from they're talking about from Carson down to Clanton, which is a significantly long portion. I walk almost every day trying to get my 10,000 steps in South End, and I'm normally doing that rail trail thing. But I tell you, I don't think drivers really get the whole concept of pedestrian crosswalks. I can't tell you how often.
No.
I mean, you can build these islands. You can build all these flashing lights and everything like that, but there's a total re-education process that needs to happen. I mean, I'm in California. I step foot on a street and the car comes to a screeching halt to let me cross. Here I'm in the middle of it. I'm dodging cars left and right in fear of my life almost every other day.
New York.
Mm-hmm. But you're right. It is an education. I mean, I know that's overused by politicians groups a lot, but there does need to be a public awareness campaign because it is awful. It is really awful.
Okay. And regarding what they're trying to do, I'm all for more sidewalks and all these things. The only thing I'm fearing, it's not coming up, but I feel like sometimes these things come up later after the conversation, is I just don't want the East Boulevard road diet. to happen to South Boulevard. I don't want them to all of a sudden squeeze the road into one lane. Yeah. And there's so much traffic there is now. And
although if you talk to the people at the city, they
that's
think
what they
that has
do.
Been a big success.
Oh, they love East Boulevard,
love
but try driving there at 5:15 in
but,
the afternoon.
But see, that's the problem, though. Is it's what do you really want? Do you really want it to be pedestrian friendly, or do you want it to be, you know, sort of the express lane? Yeah. And so that is what they're dealing with on all these projects.
Sean, you're the only person other than me that I know of in the media who has complained about East Boulevard. And I complained to the city when they were when they were thinking about it. I thought, and I said on the air, what are you thinking? And you're right, Eric. They love it.
Yeah. They absolutely they use that as an example of what should happen.
County commissioners have or are about to hear presentations on the transformation of Second Ward into a mixed-use community called Brooklyn Village. That's reminiscent of something. That's the area between, I guess, Elizabeth or 7th, McDowell, Stonewall, and Tryon. It's the whole area down there that's
the government district and the
swim center, et cetera. And that's the tip of the hat to the old Brooklyn neighborhood that used to be there before urban renewal of the 1960s. There are three competing plans. Is that what's going
on? Yes, there's three of them.
And when and how will they decide on which plan is the way to go?
Well, I think I don't know what their timetable is exactly, but after the last meeting, they left it kind of up in the air in terms of which one they really wanted, and they're going to have another meeting to decide or to at least narrow it down some more. And it's kind of hard to know where they're going to go with this because the plans are so they're so different in terms of who's offering what. I mean, at one end of the scale, you've got a plan that effectively offers the city around $18 million in exchange for these development rights. On the other end, there's like a $50 million, you know, plan for the city. And it's kind of like, wow, how can two sets of developers looking at the exact same land and the exact same market and numbers come up with such different, you know, sort of
but their plans,
scenarios?
Their plans kind of illustrate a little bit as to why. And it has to do with density, the amount of commercial space, the amount of you know, homes, basically residential units that are there. And what's interesting to me is, and this is obviously a nod to two things. Number one, Charlotte's one of the fastest growing housing markets around. House prices are booming. It's great for people who own houses who want to sell. It makes it harder for people who can afford to buy a house to buy one. But it also ignores what is the history of this area, which frankly is Charlotte's poor. And the other thing that this does is a lot of these houses, and at least one of the plans, they're rental properties, which is what millennials are more interested in, renting rather than buying. But a big complaint about all of these plans is they have about 10% or less of affordable housing in an area that used to be home to Charlotte's affordable housing.
But there's no housing in Second Ward now, is there?
Very little. There's one building.
Okay.
But it's still – so yeah, exactly. That's basically it. I think you could sleep in the NASCAR Hall of Fame without anybody noticing, but only temporarily.
Yeah. I believe Claire Fallon wanted to turn that into the homeless shelter.
But that or a library because it's really quiet. You can get a lot of reading done. But yes, going back to your point, this is always – I think this is a debate in many cities across the country because you start to see this renewal and you see this housing and very little of it is affordable. And so people – are being forced lower income people are being forced farther and farther away.
I'm a big believer in I will believe it when I see it because they've been talking about this land for over a decade. This was part of the baseball land swap, etc.
There was a pre-recession plan.
I feel like this is Eastland Mall, you know, for uptown of what we're going to do with this.
But I think this location's a lot better. I mean, I do think and the market is starting to move there when you see the Whole Foods and the apartment complex going down. Is that Stonewall? I should know. It's right by my office.
Yes, but it is.
Yeah. So, you know, the market is starting to nudge that way. So it looks more hopeful, I think, than last time.
Let's move on to an exciting topic, coal ash. The state's environmental department has decided that all of Duke Energy's coal ash ponds have to be excavated, but they've also asked the legislature to change the coal ash law and let the Department of Environmental Quality reconsider its decisions in 18 months. Why?
Well, first of all, it puts you past the election year window. And second of all, if they do reclassify, there is a potential that some of those coal ash pits, those ponds that are now that now need to be cleaned up by Duke Energy by, I believe, 2024, could be reclassified lower, which gives the company more time, or also would allow them to do what's known as cap in place, which basically means they attempt to seal it. Put something over the top of it and more or less
rather
leave it
than
as it
just
is.
Rather than actually removing everything and getting all the toxic material out.
Is this push coming from the Department of I used to be called Diener, they've changed their name, from the Department of Environmental Quality, or is it coming from Duke Energy?
Well, that's the most interesting aspect of this story. Officially, it's coming from the Department of Environmental Quality. But we've seen, and actually I believe Nick talked about this last week on our program, the Southern
Environmental Law Center.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I got the site right. They've been deposing people about these coal ash cases. And what they found was that a top DEQ person has said that, you know, Duke Energy came over to us and really talked to us a lot about this. And then all of a sudden, this was specific, I believe, just to the drinking water standards. But it's looking like Duke Energy, or at least their lobbyists, have had a lot of conversations. And so there are direct allegations that the company is pushing for this to save money.
Nick reported last week that the department withdrew the do not drink the water recommendation at the urging of Duke Energy. And now Duke insists that private wells have not been contaminated, but they are studying what it would take to extend municipal water lines to plant neighbors. Why would they be doing that?
Well, the reason they give is to, I think it was to sort of preserve peace of mind, but at the same time saying that the well water is safe. So the other piece that's in this, you know, instantly people are skeptical, or at least some people are skeptical of that. The other thing that's going on, Tom kind of made reference to this, which is the political aspect. You know, again, the fact that Governor Pat McCrory worked for Duke Energy for 30 years is always part of this conversation as well.
Well, and there's a couple other reasons, too. There are people who could understandably see this as something a little nefarious. But you could also just look at this from a legal standpoint. And this is – think about all the times that you see court cases settled where companies don't actually admit fault, but they're willing to pay something to make it go away. I'm willing to bet that some actuary at Duke has sat down and realized it may be cheaper for them to simply build out these municipal lines than have to pay any potential costs or even other settlements. So the other thing, too, is maybe this is a bargaining chip. This is actually something that David Borax and I were trying to figure out the other day, he's our environmental reporter, and maybe this is also a bargaining chip for Duke when it comes to that reevaluation of ponds in 18 months. So there's all kinds of different reasons that they could want to do this, and frankly, maybe they are trying to be good neighbors. Yeah. I mean, we have to at least –
and remember,
throw that out.
We should also throw in that Duke is – I don't believe they've gotten approval for this yet, but they want to pass on the cost to consumers for whatever form of cleanup there is there. And, you know, there is an argument to be made, at least for some portion of that cost, to be borne by consumers because we are the ones who use the power for years and years. But, you know, there's also a counter to, hey, wait a minute, we didn't know exactly – how damaging this was in terms of what you were doing with it and how you're storing it.
Former state budget director, philanthropist, CEO Art Pope was in the news this week, and he spoke with NPR's Ari Shapiro, who called him, to put him into context for a national audience, called him a kingmaker in North Carolina, to which, of course, Art Pope laughed. But they were talking to him about whether or not he would back the GOP frontrunner, Donald Trump. And he disagrees. Art Pope disagrees with RNC Chairman Reince Priebus, who has said that you have to rally around the nominee to win. Art Pope played a major role in turning the state Republican at the legislative level and at the gubernatorial level. He doesn't support Trump. He doesn't support Hillary. What's he proposing to do?
He's still trying to figure that out. I mean, the interview is really interesting, and Pope was very forthright about it. The biggest thing that he has done, at least the most visible thing I should say that he has done, is, of course, backing with his money a lot of conservative candidates from top of the ticket on down. He's not going to give money to Trump, he says. And this is actually a lot more complicated because he wants to focus on down ballot races, which is what a lot of people who are not in – who are, I should say, in the not for Trump, never Trump movement they want to do because they're afraid of the knock-on effects that a Donald Trump candidacy will that it may have on, say, the U.S. Senate or House races or even state legislative races. So Pope is going to look at ways to try to bolster those lower tickets. But what's interesting to me is actually that I think it was the day after that interview, Donald Trump's campaign and the RNC announced that they had created joint fundraising committees, which makes it actually harder for people like Art Pope to do what they want to do because now he can't simply give to the RNC, the Republican National Committee, the way he could in the past because that money would inherently be shared with Trump. Wow. So it's kind of a catch-22.
Tim, you spent some time moderating debates, I'm told, in the 9th and 12th congressional districts. Is that right?
Yes.
Sean, I'm sorry.
Yes, yes, I did last Friday at WTVI.
Five Democrats are challenging incumbent Alma Adams in her newly drawn district. What did you hear from them?
I heard of a lot of the same thing. That's the thing, a funny thing about moderating a debate in a primary. It's a lot of the answers are very similar. So whenever I try to moderate, I'm always trying to find, all right, so name specifically what you would do because we all know in that 12th district, none of you like HB2. You all love the ACA, but tell me what you would do differently with the ACA. The one thing I did notice in that 12th district, again, we got some big names in that 12th district primary with Alma Adams, Malcolm Graham, Trisha Cotham, and a couple of others. The one thing I do notice is everyone's playing the where do you live card.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. She moved. She moved.
Wasn't enough for her opponents though. Right.
Representative Adams says she now lives in 4th Ward, but that's not good enough for Malcolm Graham and Trisha Cotham.
And it wasn't her fault that the district was redrawn. She's the incumbent.
It was not her fault at all. She is the incumbent. She moved here so she could continue to be a representative in that district. But Malcolm Graham and Trisha Cotham are like, you want somebody who knows this area. You want somebody who's taught here. You want somebody who's represented here on the city council. So they're really playing that home card.
Yes. Did you also moderate the 9th district?
The 9th district, yes.
That's the race in which Robert Pittenger, the incumbent, is facing several challenges,
yes,
including Mark Harris, who is the pastor of First Baptist Church here. What did you hear from
the? Well, the unfortunate part of that one is that debate was scheduled during a House vote. Interesting enough, Representative Adams was able to do the debate, but Representative Pittenger wasn't able to get out of D.C. to do that debate. So it was between the actual debate was Mark Harris and Todd Johnson out of Union County, and then we talked to Pittenger later on.
And since I pay you so much every month, I have to ask about Charter Communications coming in, buying Time Warner Cable. Will my bill go down? That's all I care about. I don't care about anything else.
And look, Sean, you don't have to answer. Just leave it alone.
That's above my pay grade. That's your answer.
Sean directly controls that. You control that.
So let me ask you this.
Yes, in my opinion, you should get a lower bill.
Very quickly.
With fewer channels.
It came out that the Belk brothers sold Belk department stores at the perfect time because retail sales are declining. Yes. Could the same be said of Time Warner that they sold the cable system at the right time because everybody's going to Netflix?
You can't keep asking the Time Warner guy these questions. That's just mean.
Well, no, it's actually fine because I probably know about the same as you all know. And I'm asking a lot of the same questions. Obviously, we've been trying to sell for 2 years. At first, it was Comcast. Now it's Charter. I know it increases the footprint in North Carolina, and we're all very excited about it.
All we know is that print media is soaring, Mike.
Yes.
Sean.
And will continue to.
Sean, go with God. Sean Flynn, managing editor of Time Warner Cable News. Eric Frazier, editorial writer with the Charlotte Observer. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer, part-time comedian with the Charlotte Business Journal. And Tom Bullock, reporter with WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour's fun.
Charlotte